Welcome to JS on Politics, our weekly look at politics in Wisconsin and what's happening in Madison or what's not happening in Madison this week. I'm your host, Greg Borowski, and let's give you a quick rundown of what's on our show. We're going to look at the continued holdup in Madison on the state budget and what state senators want in order to stop holding it up. We'll try to answer the question, will it hold up Scott Walker's presidential announcement? We'll take a look at Russ Feingold and where his progressive PAC money went. Then we'll look at a new PolitiFact piece examining Governor Walker's cheaper to keep them argument for new Bucks Arena. We'll also take a look at some recent budget items on the Truth-O-Meter. And of course, we'll take some reader questions all in the next 30 minutes or
so. Our favorite segment, reader questions.
Reader questions. We love the questions. We're going to have to hang on until we get to those. But we're going to start with Jason Stein in Madison, one of our Madison Bureau reporters. So last week I did this, I'll do it again. The state budget expires now in 12 days, 11 hours, and about 59 minutes. There's still no deal. Has there been any progress in the last week, or are we still just kind of jammed up where we were?
I think the bottom line is there's no deal. There's been some progress. I mean, they've agreed on how much they want to cut borrowing from Governor Scott Walker's budget. But as I always say, until you figure out, you know, who's going to bear the brunt of that cost, then you don't really have a deal. And they're fighting right now over whether southeastern Wisconsin projects like the zoo interchange should just get to keep sailing smoothly forward and all the pain should be felt outstate, or whether southeastern Wisconsin shares in the pain. And it's the squabbling has gotten bad enough that Speaker Robin Voss and the Budget Committee co-chair John Nygren sent out a press release this morning criticizing Republicans in the Senate and Alberta Darling, Senator Alberta Darling, saying she was being disingenuous and misrepresenting the Assembly's position. So it's not going particularly well.
So it's divided government in Madison all over again, right?
It's divided government. There's an old joke in politics that the other party is the opposition, but the other house is the enemy. And, you know, we kind of see that going on right now with the disagreements between the Senate and Assembly.
Yeah, but there's also a lot, you know, bringing in Dan Beiser, the problems in the Senate. We don't have a very thin margin of error for the budget to pass, and a lot of people saying what they want or don't want in that budget to get
sure.
it through.
Two things. One, missing that deadline is not a huge deal. The budget will just keep on going. It used to be a routine thing that every year, every 2 years, we would miss the budget.
Sounds better if we have a little tote board.
It does.
Countdown clock, doesn't it?
Yeah, but it's not like Washington where everything shuts down. So that's an important thing. But you're right. The Republicans have no one to blame. They can't turn to the other party because they own everything. It's sort of like Colin Powell's old rule, if you break it, you own it. Here it is, if you win it, you own it. And they own everything. So they basically ended up pointing fingers at each other and trying to blame one another for the problems there.
Yeah, so Jason, who do you think, I mean, in your mind, is the key person or persons or the committee? What's it going to take to bring this all together? Is it the leadership? Is it a key senator who's holding out? Who holds the cards at this point?
Well, the person that always wields the most power is the governor, and particularly when his party controls the legislature. Right now, though, Governor Walker has been pretty content to just sit back and let Republicans in the legislature sort out their differences. But, you know, given the fact that they are not sorting them out, and we're getting closer and closer to the date that he wants to announce his run for president, it'll be interesting to see if he feels like he needs to come in and really push this thing over the finish line.
It's important to identify what the interests are that are involved here. The governor proposed a budget that was directly targeted to a national audience. Then you have the legislative leaders who are trying to put together a budget for the state. And then you have the local legislators who are focused on getting reelected. And finally, you have the special interests who want whatever they can get out of there. And so there's a tug of war between each of those four things. And the zoo interchange that Jason just mentioned is a case of that. Almost every one of these debates, the Bucks Arena debate is a debate about that. The leadership wants a deal that benefits the state, but the local legislators don't want to push something that their local constituents don't want.
Right. Well, in a case like this one, there's such a narrow margin to pass. So in the Assembly, there's a big cushion for Republicans. In the Senate, there isn't. everybody becomes more powerful. Right?
It's incredible. It feels very much like the Miller Park debate to me, where for like 2 months we were pretty sure it was going to go down to defeat, and it was only at the last second at 5 a.m. in the morning that we have eventually ended up with a deal by one vote. Who knows if we're headed in that direction?
Yeah. Well, Jason, is on the specifically on the arena deal, is this going to stay in the budget, or do they have to move it out and say twist some arms to get the Milwaukee Democrats to get behind it because of the problems they're having on the the Republican side?
Right. It really feels right now like it's going to be difficult to keep it in the budget. Although, again, really the budget is the place where it has a reasonable chance of passing.
It stands its best chance in the budget because on its
right,
own, how many Republican senators do you think would vote for a standalone budget?
I think very few. I mean, I think
you're talking about a half dozen.
But are they going to get enough Democrats get on to get for all the Republicans who want to get off? I really wonder about that. I think a lot of people that are trying to get it pulled from the budget, they just don't want to see it done.
And right now, the Democrats just can sit back and watch what's going on. They don't have to step forward and say, we think this is a great deal.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Right. Well, and in fairness, too, you hear some Republicans saying, well, the Democrats should have to vote for this. But most of those people don't actually want the arena to pass. If you talk to the Democrats and say, has anyone reached out to you to get you ready to vote? Yes, no one has. And, in politics, it's pretty rare that people just count on you doing what they want. If they really want you to do it, they'll typically come.
But at the same time, if Lena Taylor wanted to step forward and say, this is a great deal and we need to get this thing done, no one would object to that. And you've got Tim Carpenter, who's running for alderman now and has pretty much staked out a position against this. So you're not seeing any leadership on the Democratic side on this either.
No, and if you think about it, the Democrats' leaders in the legislature, in the Assembly, Peter Barca is from Kenosha, and in the Senate, where it really counts, their leader, Jennifer Schilling, is from La Crosse. So that's the other thing, too. If you had a Milwaukee leader in the legislature, they might, step forward and play a role like that. Or if Tom Barrett, the mayor of Milwaukee, or Chris Abley, the Milwaukee County exec, were close to legislative Democrats, they might be able to play that role. But there's a vacuum on the Democratic side. There's no one really there to really broker those votes. So
Abley was up there this week, though, wasn't he?
He was, but I only saw him outside the offices of Republicans. I didn't see him. Now, he may have met with some Democrats. I saw him outside of the speaker's office.
Well, we're having a little audio tech difficulty there with Jason. We're going to shift gears a little bit, though, and start with Dan here on, we want to talk about someone who's not waiting around, at least he's waiting around on the budget, perhaps, but he's not waiting around on his bid for the White House, is Scott Walker, who's this week he wrote about a potential date for an announcement.
Well, everybody's been wondering, when does he announce? Because it's a major decision. Most of the people who've announced so far are people who need oxygen for their campaign. They need some attention. But Scott Walker's not needed that sort of attention. He gets a lot of publicity in Washington and around the country anywhere he goes. So he's been it allows him to wait and wait and wait. And the two criteria that he's given us is, one, he would wait until the budget's signed. And that could be, as we know, a pretty lengthy process still. And it wouldn't be on July 4th, despite what some people on talk radio were saying. It won't be on July 4th. So I was told by three different individuals that he was targeting July 13th. Which is not unusual. Jeb Bush just announced on Monday of this week. And if you announce on a Monday, it gives you, for a week, you're in the news for the next week as people dissect your campaign. And so that's the idea, is he'll do it on the 13th. But there are so many other things, still up in the air, and in particular the budget. When I first wrote that, I had a couple people push back and say, well, there's no way the budget will be done. But most people are saying yes. But as this week continues and we see the infighting, it does look like it's a legitimate question.
Do you think if the budget isn't done by then, does he forge ahead and sort of take a little hit on his pledge to not announce until the budget's over?
I mean, that would be a strategic thing. No one's going to not vote for him because you didn't keep your pledge to wait until the budget's done. But at the same time, you know, he has set that out. They just don't want an announcement in the dead zone of August. People are on vacation. Few people are paying attention. So they're hoping middle of July.
Mm-hmm. Well, one other reason Walker's in the news this week was his little spat, sort of a David Cameron cross the ocean spat. Jason, do you want to talk about that a little bit? I know Walker went on his trip to England, and somebody came out and said, well, you know, David Cameron, the prime minister, didn't, you know, like Barack Obama or somewhat disparaging of him. And now they're going back and forth. And Walker says, I don't want to talk about this sort of thing anymore. Lesson learned, or what's the takeaway on it?
Well, the governor said there was a lesson learned. You know, this was really a pretty minor thing, except that one of the big concerns about the governor's, you know, candidacy, undeclared candidacy, is that he has a lot of accomplishments on his belt as a governor, but very little foreign affairs experience. And so really everything he does abroad is put under the microscope. And so you have this situation where he tries to just make a basic explanation of what happened in this meeting with Cameron, which, by the way, was supposed to be a purely official meeting, no politics involved. And then, you know, Cameron comes out and says, well, that's not what I said. You know, we don't know who's right, but we do know that's not what situation where Walker wanted himself
to be. You get the feeling, I mean, you said it's not a big deal. You know, he's had several of these things come up where he talks about what he heard in a particular meeting or whatever. And I always get the feeling that it's like the kid in the family who gets to sit at the adult table and they can't believe he's there. And so he tells everybody what he heard while he was at the table, and he might have gotten some of the details not quite right. I think it actually diminishes his position by going out and making, whether it's true or not true, making statements about what was supposedly said behind closed doors.
I think it runs the risk, if enough of these things happen, it sort of becomes this, you know, idea everyone sort of accepts, well, Walker's
it creates
more
a narrative.
Foreign policy.
Is he ready for prime time? Is he ready to negotiate with these people when he can't even repeat what they actually said?
All right, so his most recent trip, just finishing up, was to Canada. Again, it was this deal where the reporters weren't really along or a lot of conversation. What's the benefit to Walker for doing these trips, aside from the trade mission and the other qualities he's talking about?
I've said before, I think of politicians in terms of offensive and defensive and who's likely to be more aggressive with their agenda. And you know, Walker's been very much on offense, but because of the screw-ups that he had in England, Europe, and elsewhere, he's decided it's good to keep on doing these trips. It's on his credentials. He can say, I've visited all these places, but he doesn't have the problem of making mistakes when asking questions from the national press or international press.
All right. Well, speaking of mistakes or potential mistakes and stumbling,
this is why you're here, politics, right? Yes.
So you had a column earlier this week on Russ Feingold, who's trying to regain his Senate seat. And over the last 6 years, 5 years or so, he's raised a lot of money, spent a lot of money, but where did it go?
So what happened is in 2010, he's defeated by Ron Johnson. And in 2011, he leaves office. And shortly after he leaves office, he creates two funds, one called Progressive United Inc. and Progressives United PAC. And the PAC does political activities. The Progressives United Inc. is supposed to do some political activity up to 50%. But what I looked at is what he's done with the money over this last 4 years. And he's raised, with those two funds, $10 million. And Progressives United PAC, he's raised $7 million. And it's funny, the stated purpose was to directly and indirectly help progressive candidates, liberal candidates, but only 5% of the money he had raised actually went to that, $350,000 that went to that. Instead, the money went to administration, fundraising, 50% of it went to fundraising, and salaries for former staffers. The PAC had, Feingold got paid for it, his chief of staff got paid out of it, and 8 other former Senate and campaign staffers were paid out of that fund. So it gives this impression that it was basically a landing pad for them in between two campaigns.
Yeah, I mean, the finances, it'd be one of those red flags you see about nonprofits all the time. If they spend 90% of their money fundraising and how much actually goes to the cause.
And Progressive United Inc. is a nonprofit. It's a 501c4. They raised $2.9 million, and nearly 90% of that went to two things: salaries and fundraising. And again, it's interesting, their only response so far has been to say, you need to look at how much money we raised indirectly, which, again, it was not a great amount. It's $1.6 million. So total, all of the money raised out of that $10 million that they've raised so far, only about $2 million ends up going to candidates.
Yeah, so it's sort of this dynamic of, we'll take your money to help tell you where else to send your money. Right?
Exactly. So, that's the way it is. They are actively fundraising, and it allows them to have a full staff of 10 people, and they then endorse candidates, and they say, well, we endorse the candidates, and then we told people who to vote for.
Right. So what's the potential blowback here for Russ Feingold? I mean, his persona and his history has been, I'm a clean government kind of guy, you know, straight
arrow.
If
you're in politics, you know McCain-Feingold, and the Feingold is Russ Feingold, and he's made it his job to try to clean up messy politics and to get money, dark money, out of the system. Well, this is a case where he operated a super PAC, and most of the money ended up going to him, his staff, and to a number of vendors and clients. And so the potential is, it creates the image that he's a hypocrite, that he's saying one thing, but then you look at his fund is doing another. But what's been equally interesting to me has been the response, or the lack of a response, by the Feingold camp. Outside of pointing out that they raise money indirectly, they've not really had much of a response. Their response has been to say nothing and to put out another fundraising letter, which is to take all of this and say, look, we're under attack from Ron Johnson. And I mean, which anyone who covers politics knows, Ron Johnson is no fan of what I do. And so
let's talk briefly on that. So he, in the years past, you've written about this $10 million that he received. Is that comparable, do you think, to this, or is that a different?
It's a little bit different, but you know, he ran a company. He spent $9 million on the campaign. A month after he wins the seat, he pays himself from his own company $10 million, basically about the same amount of money that he raised. So so basically we have two candidates running in this. We have Ron Johnson, who paid himself $10 million out of his company funds, and then you've got Russ Feingold, who paid himself and a bunch of his friends $10 million out of a PAC and out of a special interest fund. So an interesting dynamic between the two of them.
Yeah, let's just briefly throw in one question from a reader. There's sort of three questions. They seem to be the same. They may even be the same person. So this might be the Stevie, Pat, Dave question, which gets at sort of the, oh, sorry, this one. Russ Feingold had an ad where he opened his closet and said, look, no skeletons. This is back way when he was first running.
Right.
Are we finding out there are skeletons now with this group, and is there more to come out of this? Does this story have legs way?
I don't think, I mean, there's more stuff that I'm looking at, and I know other people are looking at, so which is why it interested me, because the response has been almost nothing, which makes me wonder if it's a case of that he's rusty, or if is this a case of arrogance where he doesn't think this is going to touch him or affect him. And so much has been redirected into making sure he is the candidate. The field has been cleared doing that. Democrats don't usually do that. They're not that organized. But it worked for them with Tammy Baldwin to clear the field. She ends up winning. She's a U.S. Senator. They've done the same thing now. And he is the guy for good or for bad. And you know, I'm just surprised that they haven't responded more strongly.
All right. Well, thanks to Dan. We're going to turn now to the arena and the cheaper to keep them slogan that Governor Walker rolled out in announcing the latest spending plan. So we're going to start with the video of that announcement, and then we'll have some more discussion on that point.
As I pointed out here, and I said this morning, it's important to remember that what we're talking about is it's cheaper to keep them. And by that, what I mean is, if you look, here on this chart, the price of saying no is at least $419 million. So if the state does nothing in regards to an arena in the city of Milwaukee, the price of no has a cost. And we believe it's at least $419 million. That's if you add together the cost that we currently have for the impact today of revenues collected on income by NBA players we currently have, which is roughly $130 million. If you look at over the next 20 years, the impact of revenues we believe that will be collected as contracts go up, and those are very fiscally conservative estimates we've looked at in the past. We talked about our original plan, the projection of how many more revenues would come in over the next 20 years. And then you add to that the impact of the cost to the state, because of course, as part of the original Bradley Center, there are conditions that would have that facility revert onto the cost of the state. Just adding that cost just alone over the next 10 years. So it's 20 years, the lifetime of what we're talking about, the arena deal for income taxes currently collected. It's 20 years for the impact in terms of the next 20 years for revenues that be collected from income taxes as far as the growth. And then just the next 10 years cost for the Bradley Center. Those costs alone get us at least $419 million. Now obviously it can be more than that. You projected out a full 20 years for the cost of the BMO Harris Bradley Center. It becomes far greater than that, probably exceeding nearly $500 million. But just in those very conservative estimates, it's $419 million of the cost of doing nothing. Not a very good alternative. Versus right now, what we're talking about with the new arena plan, just for the state alone, the impact would be capped out at $80 million.
All right, so that was Scott Walker doing his best Ross Perot imitation with the charts and the numbers and trying to break down this cheaper to keep them argument. Tom Kircher, one of our PolitiFact reporters, had a piece today that did the same thing, maybe with a little more scrutiny than the governor offered. So let's kind of walk through some of these numbers. So the first thing we all know is that it's a $500 million deal, right? $250 million from taxpayers, $250 million from the owners. Now, then you've got the two sides. So Governor Walker wants to sort of match them up and say one is greater than the other. So the cost if the bucks stay, and the figure we've talked about is $400 million, but that's not the figure the governor used in his speech. How's he presenting it to voters?
Right. The basic equation is half and half. The public will pay half, and the bucks will pay half. But the public's half of $250 million includes $80 million from the state, as the governor indicated. But that 250 is really just a nominal number that's involved. So based on estimates that we've been told, that 250 could actually become over 20 years, more like 400 million.
All right, and in the presentation that the governor talked about 80 million, which is the stature, so he's sort of kind of got a low ball figure to start from when he's calculating this scale.
Right, 80 from the state, but that doesn't take into account the local taxpayer contribution, again, totaling $250 million plus whatever interest.
Okay. So we'll say, this is the easy part to understand. So we'll say it's $400 million, which is what people are telling us is when the bonding and interest comes in. That's the one side. So the other side of the equation is the cost of the bucks leave, and that is what the governor's pegging at $419 million. And I'm going to run through these pieces, and then we'll talk about them a little more. So $130 million of that comes from the current income taxes paid by bucks employees and the NBA players. So that when a team plays in town, they pay a share of their income tax to the state. $169 million comes from the growth in the income taxes. So over the next period of years, it's expected to increase NBA salaries and so forth. And then $120 million comes from the Bradley Center costs. So let's start with the Bradley Center costs. What does that $120 million involve? And
yeah, the $120 million is a little more difficult, I think, to nail down. The loss in state income taxes from NBA players, people can understand. If we don't have an NBA arena, NBA players don't pay income taxes. The $120 million that the governor is including is money that the Bradley Center has in expenses and in debts. And the $120 million, he has said, there exists on the books, so to speak, has not been independently verified. So for him to include that and say, gee, that would be a cost to taxpayers, we don't know independently if that $120 million is solid. Secondly, we don't know that taxpayers from the state would necessarily be held responsible for that. His argument is, look, if the bucks leave, the Bradley Center's in financial trouble, the state would have to step in and pick up this $120 million.
Well, it is, that's though, for readers, I mean, viewers, though, they don't... The state does have a specific role, right? This is the Bradley Center, when it was created as a gift from the Jane Pettit. It's an instrumentality of the state. There is a role. It's not like the state is just sweeping in and being assigned the potential debt and costs, right?
That's true. I mean, certainly it's not as though the state would have to rescue it sort of out of the goodness of its heart. It does have an ownership interest in the Bradley Center and, you know, potentially could be tapped to pick up any expenses or debt that the Bradley Center has, but that's not as firm, let's say, as the governor makes it seem.
Right, okay. So let's roll back to that question of the income taxes. And you and I pay income taxes. We're not LeBron James, so when he comes to town, he pays a little bit more, and that's why the state's interested in that, and that's kind of the heart of the argument. So there's some we think is a pretty solid number that here's what they have paid, and that number's been consistent and going up. That's the 130, mm-hmm. correct? So what about the growth? How certain is that, or what are the red flags that people should be watching on that point?
Yeah, there's certainly an expectation that if the NBA players keep playing in Milwaukee, that the taxes they pay to the state will rise. The NBA just signed a huge TV contract that will certainly, in the next few years at least, raise the salaries of NBA players. Therefore, they would pay more income taxes to the state. But going out over 20 years, that projection is a little harder to figure. Who knows what the TV contracts might be down the road, what salaries might end up being. So it's a little bit more of a difficult number 20 years out.
Right. And people, there was also in your story, they talked about what's called the substitution effect. So it's not quite as direct as if you're taking just money people already spend. I mean, that some of this money will show up in state coffers sort of indirectly and wind its way around.
So if we lose the Bucks, we lose the NBA income tax payments. But that doesn't mean people who go to Bradley Center to Bucks games spend money on tickets, spend money at the facility, would just sit on that money. They would spend it maybe on other sporting events or in other forms of entertainment. And that, in turn, generates taxes of its own. If a business is suddenly making more money, able to pay their employees more money, that generates taxes. So to some extent, we lose the income tax payments from the NBA players, but at least some of that would be made up through other taxes.
All right. We should note we didn't put this one to the Truth-O-Meter in part because there isn't even a drafted bill yet to look at, and there hasn't none of these numbers have been vetted by the Fiscal Bureau or others to really tell how certain they are. So we just tried to provide good background information for people in that story.
Right.
Some things we did put to the Truth-O-Meter, and that's where we'll bring in Jim Nelson, one of our other PolitiFact reporters. And we're going to go through some recent fact checks we did all on the state budget, and then we'll have some time for questions at the end. So the first statement we're looking at is from Scott Walker, and the statement was, fundamental changes made to the language describing the Wisconsin idea and the University of Wisconsin system's mission statement were the result of a, quote, drafting error. And we rated that pants on fire. Let's start with the hot ones. Tom, you go first.
You know, the Wisconsin idea is a general notion that the university system exists in part to help the state generally, public service. And in the budget, with the proposed by the governor, there was language directing the UW system to say, look, we are going to redraft the Wisconsin idea. The UW system, we found, pushed back on that, didn't want to change it. There was some back and forth in emails between Walker's administration and the UW, So clearly, the governor's administration initiated the proposed change to the Wisconsin idea and kind of fought back and forth with the UW over whether to change it.
All right. The next statement is from Peter Barca, who said the average faculty member at UW-Madison brings in close to $250,000 a year in grant money. And our rating on that was mostly true. Jim, give us a sense of that one.
Well, the UW statistics showed, the UW itself said that each faculty member, on average, brings in $242,000 to support research. And so Barco is right on the dollar figure, but it's on average. What he didn't say is of 2,173 faculty members, 59% of them have research grants. The rest don't.
Right. So this one, the statement was in the context of you can't cut faculty because we're bringing in all this money, but there are many faculty who don't have that same thing.
Don't bring in any money.
All right, so this one is from UW Chancellor Rebecca Blank, who said UW-Madison, quote, spent down reserves, end quote, as it was told to do 2 years ago and facing new state budget cuts, has no more reserves to spend down. We rated that half true. Tom?
Yeah, people might remember a couple years ago it was disclosed that the UW system and its campuses had amassed some pretty significant reserves. That was a surprise to a lot of lawmakers. So there's no doubt there was pressure on the campuses to spend down some of that extra money, and UW-Madison did do that. But we also found out that it's not as though they were left with nothing. There was about $387 million left, including $54 million that wasn't identified for any particular purpose.
We're close on running out of time, so we're going to try to zip through these a little more quickly. And we've got Mike Tate. A Republican budget proposal would have Wisconsin with the weakest standards for who can be a teacher in a in the classroom in the country. Tom, we rated that one half true.
2 points on that one. The change would apply only to 6th through 12th grade teachers, so it's not across the board. On the other hand, Wisconsin apparently would become the only state that would not require a bachelor's degree for teachers in certain subjects like foreign languages and health.
Okay, and this is from Chris Taylor, a state representative, says Governor Walker's proposed state budget contained 110 pages of errors, an unusually high number, and, quote, millions of dollars worth of mistakes that were corrected with a follow-up document. Briefly, Jim, we rated that mostly true.
Two words, errata report. That's the technical
term.
That's
errata, just for people who are censors who might be listening. Go ahead.
That's the technical term for we need to fix some mistakes that we made drafting an 1,800-page budget. And, yes, there were mistakes made, and one of them was a whopper, a $15 million mistake.
All right, and we'll take one question from readers that we have in our time that's left on PolitiFact. This question was from James Jones. I don't believe it's the former Packer, but we don't know. It says, I don't understand your scale. A half-truth is a lie, but you guys don't treat it that way. And what does it take to get a pants on fire? So give us the definition, Tom, of half-true.
Half-true is a statement that is partially accurate, but leaves out important details or takes things out of context. Pants on fire, as you might guess, at the bottom of our scale, not only is the statement not accurate, but it makes a claim that we find to be ridiculous.
All right. So thank you for joining us on our show today. We'll be back next week. Hopefully, if my expense request went through, we'll be broadcasting from Summerfest, because everybody does that on the opening day. We'll see you next Thursday.